Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much for being here. Today is Monday the 8th. We have three bills that are up for public hearing, possible work session, plus a work session independent of that. What we're going to do, based on time restraints of individuals and the number of individuals we have for the various bills, we're going to start with Senate Bill 1555. We're then going to go to 1553, and then we'll finish up with 1576, since it has the most activity of people wanting to be here and needing to put stuff on the records. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up the first public hearing, Senate Bill 1555. Whitney.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, this is Senate Bill 1555, and it is brought to us today by Senator Brzozinski. There is no revenue impact, and we are still waiting on the fiscal impact statement. Yeah. Law enforcement agencies would like the option to use polygraph examinations as a school tool to screen law enforcement candidates to ensure the hiring of the highest quality law enforcement officers. Okay. Several other states allow for this use of polygraph examination. Currently, Oregon law prohibits the use of polygraphs in screening applicants. Senate Bill 1555 amends existing law to allow for polygraph examination as a condition of employment for law enforcement officers. It does not allow the use of polygraph examinations after an officer is hired. There is also an exception. Senate Bill 1555 exempts the polygraph materials from disclosure under public records law, and there's also a -1 amendment brought to us by the committee. This amendment adds an additional requirement that the use of polygraphs is subject to an applicable collective bargaining agreement.
All right, thank you very much. So what I'm going to do is first call, it looks like it's going to be Chief Kearns. Pete, why don't you come up, please? And I also have Richard Pellegrin.
Yes.
So he's going to be on the phone. Oh, those two are going to be on the phone. Okay. So, Pete, why don't you start off, and then we'll come and pick up the other two, and then we have two others after that.
Very good. Good morning, Senator. And thank you for changing the order so that Dr. Roberts can be on the phone with us today. My name is Pete Kearns. I'm the Eugene Police Chief. And on the phone is Dr. Mike Roberts, who's a psychologist. He conducts pre-employment psych exams for police departments in a number of different states, some of which allow use of the polygraph, so he has an interesting perspective on this subject. And then our other guest is Rich Peregrin, who has the title of Chief Examiner. He's been a polygraph examiner since 1984, has conducted more than 25,000 polygraph exams, and he's works in the state of Washington. He's worked with their legislative committee there since 1986. He has a great deal of experience, and I'm sure he can answer just about any question you might have. As you stated earlier in the reading of the bill, there is a few things more important to our community and to our police departments than hiring the right people to be police officers, deputies, troopers, and corrections officers. And the consequences of not conducting that process well can be extreme. For our department in 2002, we convicted one of our patrol officers for raping more than a dozen women, most of whom were prostitutes, and he'll spend the rest of his life in prison. And following that, the International City County Managers Association, together with the Police Executive Research Forum, conducted a review of our department's hiring and internal affairs practices. They gave us more than 50 recommendations for hiring and for internal affairs. And one of those was that we use the polygraph exam and pre-employment screening, which hasn't been possible in Oregon. Since that time, we have implemented the changes that they recommended. We've monitored closely the best practices for hiring and for background investigations in Oregon. And despite all those efforts, this last year, we prosecuted another member of our department who was identified by the Department of Justice's Internet Crimes Against Children. And he was found to be downloading child pornography. And when a search warrant was conducted on his home, we also learned that before he was hired by our department, he had hidden miniature video cameras in a place of employment where he'd captured video of men using the urinal. And after he was hired, he did the same thing at a rest stop here where he captured similar video of young men, underage children, using a urinal at a rest stop, and then some of our police officers doing the same in our headquarters building. He'll spend more than 7 years in prison following those and other crimes. There was just this last year a Portland case in which pre-screen polygraph may have enabled the Portland Police Bureau from having to hire a person who was later convicted of sexual offenses. So the need for this is great, and what we've learned in our analysis, our study of other states, is that the polygraph can be a valuable tool in allowing employers to screen out people who shouldn't be in this line of work. In discussing with the subject with labor, their greatest concern is that perhaps not immediately, but someday this a statute like this could enable employers to use a polygraph on incumbents in personnel matters, which is why the clause that had been added that enables it only in those places that have a collective bargaining agreement that addresses this would be good. And that's all I've got for the moment. I'm happy to answer questions, but I think it would be good if we introduced Dr. Roberts at this time.
Yeah, I think we're going to go ahead and take the other testimony. Are both of them going to be on the same phone?
No, them independently.
Then Dr. Roberts is the first one that has the time frame. Why don't we go with him? Good morning, Dr. Roberts. This is Floyd Przonski, state senator who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much for being available. I understand that.
No problem. Glad to do it.
Thank you. I understand you're going to give us testimony on Senate Bill 1555. Well, I'll ask you to first state your name for the record, then if you'll proceed with your testimony.
Yes, fine. It's Michael Roberts.
Go ahead.
And you want me to just tell you what I think are points about the polygraph at this point in time?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah. Chief Kearns has asked me to be available to make comments on the basis of my experience using the polygraph in different agencies. And I've prepared some talking points that I think would be helpful in the consideration of whether the state of Oregon wants to move that direction. So in summary, the first point is that the polygraph, when used in police selection, is primarily an information-gathering tool, that it markedly improves the value of character assessment procedures such as the background and the psych. It is used in the job selection process not to determine guilt or innocence, like criminal investigations. In fact, fewer than 5% of applicants are identified by polygraph operators as what they call deceptive or lying. And most of those are because they flagrantly use countermeasures such as excessive body movements or deep breathing or use of anti-anxiety drugs, which they're prohibited from doing. They're told about ahead of time, but they do it anyway. So in summary, it's the admission of negative behavior during the polygraph process for police and public safety positions that are used by the department's background investigators to reject applicants. It is not the opinion of the polygraph operator, and I think that's a major misconception by most people. The use of the polygraph in the selection process results in a doubling of negative behavioral admissions, such as arrest, spouse abuse, and job terminations. We've done extensive studies nationally looking at the results in the sense of making negative admissions about pre-hire behavior when the agencies have a polygraph in the system versus those that do not. And in almost every category, for example, spouse abuse goes from 4 to 9%. There's a variety of other things that I'm sure are available in the handout that I provided last June. The second point is that the polygraph, if it isn't used in the selection process, the department will hire applicants who have lied about their pre-hire behavior. Now, this can happen anyway, even with the polygraph, but the reality is that it's much less likely that you'll hire people who the department did not know about their negative behavior. This is important for a couple of reasons. And one of those is that people who have committed negative behavior before being hired are at much greater risk of continuing that pattern of norm and rule violation after being employed as a public safety, you know, police officer, firefighter, that sort of thing. The second point that it's important to use the polygraph is that not including it is really very unfair to job applicants who actually tell the truth about their past negative behavior, and then they get rejected. But the applicant with the same negative behavior history gets lies and gets hired because of that deception. So it's really unfair to the ones that play by the rules, and even though they have a negative behavior, they're out. But the other liars actually get hired, which is, of course, not good for the Department of the Public. Third point, four, is that there's the potential negligent hiring issue if an applicant who has a negative pre-hire history is hired due to their deceptive responses because the department did not exercise due diligence by using the polygraph, which is the norm for police agencies, particularly on the West Coast. Some states don't permit it, like Oregon, but most states do, and most states use it. But particularly on the West Coast, it's very, very common in police agencies. So it could be looked at or regarded as, you know, you didn't do a careful enough review to find out they had a negative history. And finally, the use of the polygraph is cost-effective. The typical process of giving it, getting the applicant's admissions on the polygraph, which the polygraph usually costs about $200, it can result in them not being processed through the much more invasive and expensive procedures like the psychological, which costs on average about $400 per applicant, and the full field background, the cost extrapolated from officer time. It takes about a week of officer investigations to do one, so that's about $2,500. So those are my four points. If that sums it up, and if any questions, I would be happy to respond.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Roberts. Let me see if there are any questions from anyone on the panel. Senator Gelser first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I wanted to clarify, were you suggesting that the polygraph would replace background checks and psychological evaluations?
Well, no, it enhances. No, there's always got to be, there has to be a background investigation, as there is right now in the state of Oregon. All agencies use a background investigation, and that's critical because they actually go out and talk to previous employers, and they talk to wives or girlfriends or husbands about the applicant and co-workers and references. They actually talk to the people, and I think that's a critical element. The problem is that they cannot verify the accuracy of the information that's being provided by those sources sometimes, and certainly not by the applicant, who is, in many cases, about 20% of them make a sincere effort to avoid being honest about their history.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Dr. Roberts? Dr. Roberts, thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck with your deliberations.
All right. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. And our next individual is Rich Peregrine. Peregrine. Let's go one more. Yeah. We'll come back. All right, so that takes care of. Let's first see if there's any questions for Chief Kearns.
Senator, if it would help, I can summarize what I've learned from Mr. Peregrine.
Why don't we do that just in case we don't get him, since we got a very tight schedule today?
Sure. The benefit of his experience is that it gives a pretty good outline of what the experience is, what the process is like for the police agencies that use these in Washington State. This is just one piece of the hiring process, just like background investigations and psychological exams and the interview process. We wouldn't eliminate any of those if we had an option. And for those agencies in Washington that use this, they wouldn't eliminate this one either. The applicant completes a 150-question questionnaire, personal history questionnaire, that's reviewed before the exam by the polygrapher. The polygrapher and the candidate meet together. They carefully go through the exam. They both become familiar with exactly what the questions are that will be asked during the exam, and they're both familiar with what the answers are that will be delivered by the candidate during the exam. Polygrapher learns what's making the candidate uncomfortable. They work through those questions, and sometimes it's because they stole a pencil when they were a kid, and the polygrapher can make clear those aren't their concerns. They're more serious than that. And just as Dr. Roberts described, they find more and more admissions from this than they would otherwise, and they find it to be a very valuable tool.
All right. Thank you. So any other questions, follow-up from that additional information? Pete, thank you very much. I'm going to have you stand back, and then I'm going to go ahead and call up our last two witnesses that are signed up, Kimberly McCullough and Mike Savigio. I want you to come forward. While they're coming forward, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1555? And Greg, why don't you come on up?
Yes.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Salvaggio here for the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs, representing line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state. Firstly, I want to say I know that the Dash 1 amendments were posted yesterday evening, and our attorney and our board members have those in hand right now, and I've been checking my email while in the audience, but so far no movement, no position on those, and I apologize. But our current position on the regular bill is in opposition, not only because of the blanket allowance without the collective bargaining element, which I do appreciate the movement towards, but also because of a concern with the way polygraphs are perceived and our concern with the way that they may be implemented. There's a, I think, understanding in popular culture that a polygraph is a lie detector. I think that the testimony from the professionals that you heard earlier, they would concede that it is not a lie detector. It is simply an outline of biometric data, and in no way should supplant the work of investigations, background checks, et cetera. And while I realize that Dr. Roberts indicated that it should not be a replacement, I am concerned that there is a section where we talked about cost effectiveness and how this would cost about $200 compared to investigation and psych background. This is one of our big concerns, is that the use of polygraphs would be seen by departments, by the general public, as, well, it's okay, this individual went through a lie detector test, thinking that that was kind of all right. Of course, that would detect any lies, and then in the absence of a proper background check and psych evaluation, that would be seen as sufficient. So I just want to put on record, I think I'm agreeing with Dr. Roberts on that, that would not be sufficient. I also want to draw attention to the report that was commissioned by the United States Department of Energy back in 2002 by the National Academy of Sciences, where they were specifically asked about the use and value of polygraphs and pre-employment screenings for security purposes. I want to echo that I'm not a polygrapher, I'm not a psychologist, so I'm just going to read a couple of quotes out of here. Accuracy is almost certainly lower when tests are used this way, meaning pre-employment security screening, than an investigation of specific incidents. So while there may be some value for backgrounding specific incidents, the idea of just the general screening, I think, is not exactly what the polygraph is best suited for. I can just enter the rest of that into the record if it pleases the committee, but at any rate, I'll pause for any questions and let you know as soon as we have a position on the Dash 1 amendments.
All right. Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I can go next. This is Kimberly McCullough from the ACLU of Oregon. I'm not going to add a terribly huge amount because I think a lot of what I have to say mirrors what was just said. But we have had concerns about the same type of bill, which has been raised numerous times throughout the years. I found articles about this from, over 10 years ago with us taking essentially the same position. And the reason is that while we share the goal of making sure that our officers are the best officers possible, we have deep concerns about the fact that polygraph exams are just not they're frequently very inaccurate. And because of that inaccuracy, you can't use them in criminal cases. We have statutes on the books that prohibit their use in the employment context. And we have deep concerns that using them in one context could legitimize their potential use in another context. And when this is something that we've made a decision not to use because of the fact that it's led folks astray in the criminal context in particular, it seems that it could potentially be something that is relied upon. I understand that there's this whole procedure for having these conversations and going through a process, but it does seem that it could potentially lead people astray in thinking that they've adequately screened someone when the exam itself can give false results. So that's just where we're at.
All right. Thank you. Greg?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Greg Peden here on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. Newspaper publishers support this bill, particularly the intent of the bill as described by the police chief this morning. The section that we are concerned about is simply the public interest section of the public records statute. As you, I think, heard, the way the bill is currently written, it would be an automatic exemption for this information to be part of public records. We would like that section of the bill to be changed to what I think all of you are well versed in is known as the public interest test section, where folks like the media or really anybody who's part of the public could come and say, this is part of the police officer's personnel file and an incident that might be of public interest. We could come in and explain to a court why we think this is should be a public record. Anybody who would oppose that can make their arguments, and a judge would decide. That would be a more fair process. I think that's typical of the type of decision that's made on a personnel file that would be arguably public interest. And so this moving that in this section would be consistent with where things already are. And that's our concerns with the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if who might want to respond to this, but in some written testimony that we got from Larry O'Day, the police chief of Portland, he says that since we're starting to experience staffing shortages in law enforcement generally, and because polygraphs are allowed for pre-employment in Washington and California, that we're starting to get an influx of people who are not hired because of failing polygraphs in those states, and they're coming and applying to jobs in our state. And I wonder if Mike or anybody wants to respond to that as a problem or how we should deal with that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would like to hire additional police officers, not just in Portland, but around the state. We want the absolute best quality individuals for those positions. And it is in our interest, and I think everybody's interest, to make sure that bad apples, so to speak, are weeded out. But in our view, hooking applicants up to a biometric reader is far less of a an accurate measure than, to use a tired old phrase, good old-fashioned police work. A psychology examination, background investigations, and the real face-to-face kind of investigations. And we would support additional funding for those purposes, but the concern again that we have is that we become an employer who simply hooks up to a test that is frequently in error or simply insufficient to consistently and accurately detect lies, and we see that as a good substitute for that kind of background check.
All right, any other comments? I'm going to just put something on the record for both Kimberly and for Michael to get back to us. First of all, I'd like to see if you can find anything out of California or Washington State where they do, in fact, use this, where you've had the negative. Second, what I'm hearing is, oh, my gosh, the sky's going to be falling, but no one's showing me that we're actually going to be changing anything. Everyone's protocol is going to be the same. No one's saying that we're going to get away from doing extensive background checks on these individuals. What my understanding is, this will give the background check evaluators the opportunity to have information they may not have by these biometrics to actually be able to do good police work and dig deeper. But no one's saying that this is going to be a replacement. So if y'all can find some cases out of the West Coast where we're now, it appears to be potentially a dumping ground for people who are not making it in Washington State or in California, but ending up in Oregon, and where one of my communities have now had two officers who are now in prison for the horrendous acts they've done to people in the community, I think we need to look at other ways that we can be better than what we're at now, and what we have and what we've had for the last 10 to 15 years just isn't making it today. So that's my statement. Thank you very much. Any other comments? Thank you all very much. And if you want to get back to us, I'd appreciate it. Absolutely. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1555. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1553. Shanna?
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1553 is one of your Senate judiciary bills. As you may recall, this has the relating to clause of relating to crime. And as such, it has two major issues in it at the moment. The first allows for an unlimited statute of limitation on first-degree sex crimes when the prosecuting attorney receives additional corroborative evidence of a crime. Specifically, this additional evidence could be physical evidence other than a DNA sample, a confession of a crime, contemporaneous oral or written statements, or a report made by a different victim alleging the defendant committed the crime. The second issue includes with an assault in the third degree, causing physical injury to another by means of a motor vehicle with criminal negligence. We have a number of amendments for you. The proposed -1 amendments are a new concept that would be added to the bill that would prohibit the disclosure of images of death as part of a law enforcement investigation if release of those images would constitute an unreasonable invasion of privacy on the deceased person's family. The proposed -2 amendments limit the assault 3 provisions, that second part of the bill, to those who are vulnerable road users. These are pedestrians, highway workers, persons riding animals, and persons operating tractors, skateboards, inline skates, scooters, or bicycles. The proposed -3 and -4 amendments make a couple of clarifying changes to what a substantially similar crime would be. The proposed -5 amendments clarify that any misdemeanor, Class C felony, or felony punishable as a misdemeanor is eligible for set-aside. This is a clarification on a measure we enacted last session, just a little cleanup. The proposed -6 amendments clarify what kind of statement needs to be made by another person in order to reopen the statute of limitations. And the proposed -7 amendments clarify that the confession by the defendant must be to the crime reported by the victim.
All right, thank you. We have a number of individuals who want to testify on different portions of this bill. So our first panel is going to include individuals we believe are here to testify regarding the statute of limitation provisions: Brenda Tracy, Danielle Tudor, Jeff Howells, and Aaron Knott. Why don't you four please come up together?
I guess I'll kick off then, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. My name's Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General and the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of the statute of limitations portion of Senate Bill 1553. Statute of limitations are a legislative construct, meaning you can set them pretty much wherever you want to without any constitutional entanglements. And because of that, when you look across the country, they vary dramatically. Generally speaking, they try to strike a balance between the inevitable loss of evidence over time versus the seriousness of a crime. And that's the approach that we take in Oregon. Statutes of limitations can be as short for felonies as 3 years, all the way out to forever for every type of murder, from aggravated murder all the way down to all types of manslaughter. This bill, 1553, comes about as the result of a work group chaired by Senator Przanski, coming out of the last session, where we extended the statute of limitations for first-degree sex crimes only from 6 years to 12 years. That's rape, sodomy, unlawful sexual penetration, and sex abuse, all in the first degree. And a quick note about sex abuse, because I think it's the least obvious of the four of those, and I've heard it described a number of different ways. Sex abuse in the first degree is sexual touching, which is when you touch somebody else with sexual intent. It doesn't have to be on their genitals or buttocks. It can be anywhere in their person. However, to get to first degree, there has to be a very limited factor. Number one, the individual has to be under 14 years of age. And again, this is beyond a reasonable doubt being done with sexual intent. They have to be incapable by statute, meaning they're incapacitated in some way, either mentally or physically. Or finally, you have to use forcible compulsion, which the Court of Appeals has construed as overcoming resistance. An example of that, which was cited by the court, is forcing somebody's hand down your pants for the purpose of making them touch your own genitals. So those are the crimes we're talking about. Those are the only crimes that are affected here. So what 1553 does is it allows the extension of a statute of limitations beyond what is currently in statute, as long as there is corroborating evidence, meaning if it's just the statement of the victim alone with nothing else, you don't become eligible for the extension. I'll mention very briefly the four types of evidence that are qualifying for an extension. I am mindful of your time. The first contemplated by 1553 would be physical evidence. As our society becomes more fully digitized, you can envision a future where more and more evidence will be retained over time. Emails, text messages are increasingly available far after the commission of a crime because they're housed on a server or something like that. And they're housed in their original form. Once an email, for example, is sent, you have no ability to change it. So if that email is found 10, 15 years later, which Google and others have given us every indication to believe may be the future, it's still the same as it was the day it was sent. So physical evidence is one form of corroboration. The second would be confessions made by the defendant. This follows but from a change that was made in Indiana, where an individual walked into a police precinct the day after the lapse of a statute of limitations and basically said, "Surprise, I did it. You can't do a thing about it." So we'd be following Indiana's lead in closing what right now is a fairly gaping loophole for that strategy. Three, it's corroborating testimony by somebody other than the victim. When you find yourself the subject of this violent an assault, and again, these are only your first degree crimes, so these are the most horrendous sex crimes we have in statute, the scope of your trauma may be too much for you to go directly to law enforcement, but that doesn't mean you don't tell anyone. You may tell somebody you're more comfortable with. You may tell a care worker, social worker, friend. And then when you're finally ready to come forward, even if that's after the presumptive statute of limitations and that person lives in Maryland now, if they can recall the very specific details of what you told them at that time, it has a tendency to corroborate what they stated. Finally is corroboration by a second victim. And not to be overly colloquial, but in our own discussions of this, it's the question raised by Bill Cosby, which is an individual comes forward and claims a rape, and victims find they're no longer alone. And when they're no longer alone, it's easier to tell that story. And the next thing you know, you have 2, 3, 5, 10 victims all alleging a very similar assault. And while Bill Cosby's a celebrity, it's not at all unique to him. This is the nature of victimization. When you are less alone, it is easier to tell that story. And that, too, is a tendency to prove corroboration. Now, the last point I want to make is that this doesn't change the burden of proof. This just gets a case started. It still has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And in fact, it's my belief that what this bill does creatively and does well, is codify what is already the reality for prosecutors across across the state. Most cases that are this old simply won't go to trial because they cannot be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. What this bill attempts to do is sweep up the exceptional and meritorious case where corroborating evidence exists, the kind of case that a prosecutor should go forward with because it can be proven with solid evidence despite the exceptional passage of time. I anticipate even if this bill is passed, it will be used rarely. That's the nature of prosecuting a 20-year-old case. But we know that those meritorious cases exist, and right now there is no justice for those victims. I'm open for any questions.
All right, thank you. Let's go ahead and take the testimony from the other panelists.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Howes. I'm the first assistant to District Attorney Rod Underhill in Multnomah County. I've been a prosecutor for 21 years, and I want to give you a little bit of my background because I think it informs my testimony. For 6 years, I prosecuted major felony domestic violence, and one of my main focuses was domestically violent sexual assaults. During that time, I learned all of the reasons why a victim may delay a report. And you know all of them, and I'll touch just on a couple. A victim will not report until he or she feels safe. And that can be a long time coming for a victim of a violent sexual assault. There's other factors, societal, financial, post-traumatic stress. All of these things will cause a victim to delay a report of a sexual assault. During that time, I prosecuted a man named Edward Stokes. Edward Stokes was a serial rapist who preyed on preteen, teen, and young adult males. His victims were often loath to report their sexual assault. By the time I got the case, the sexual assaults in question were 8-plus years old, beyond the 6-year statute of limitations that was in effect at the time. Only because we were able to bootstrap an argument that Mr. Stokes had been out of the state, provably out of the state, were we able to extend that statute of limitations by an extra 3 years. That enabled me to prosecute Mr. Stokes. He was convicted of 2 sexual assaults and is currently serving 200 months in prison. I worked for 3 years in the child abuse unit in my office. We would often purposefully delay the onset of a prosecution while a young victim of sexual assault was in therapy, getting to the point where that victim could come and testify at grand jury and possibly face his or her accuser at trial. Finally, I worked for 5 years with the Portland Police Bureau Cold Case Homicide Unit, prosecuting cases. As you know, with homicides, there is no statute of limitations, but I prosecuted cases upwards of 30 years old. One in particular was a sexual assault and a homicide that occurred in 1973. And in 2012, Frederick Ritchie was convicted of that crime and sentenced to life in prison. I'm here to support the statute of limitations portion of Senate Bill 1553 and to voice the support of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I have proposed a couple of amendments, and I've worked with Council Newell get those to you. There's a couple of things that I think should be addressed by this committee before this bill moves forward. On page 5, line 11, the word contemporaneously is used when talking about corroborative evidence. I went to the dictionary, as lawyers often do, and looked up contemporaneously. That means at the same time, at the same time. So if we're talking about a report that was made to a friend, to a colleague, that was written in a diary, something like that, contemporaneously, that would mean literally that the report was made at the same time that the assault occurred. And I don't think that's what this bill is intended to do. I suggested a little more cumbersome language, but more accurate language in temporal proximity to the assault. In paragraph, the whole of paragraph 12, small b, large c, it's a little vague, and what I suggested was that those two sentences be broken out into two separate sentences. Sub C would read, an oral statement provided by the victim to another person made in temporal proximity to the commission of the crime, corroborating the victim's report of the crime to a law enforcement agency. And large D, a written statement made by the victim in temporal proximity to the commission of the crime and subsequently delivered to another person or to a law enforcement agency, corroborating the victim's report of the crime to the law enforcement agency. Finally, And I know you received written testimony from Erin Olson. Erin Olson's a former prosecutor, and now she represents victims of crime all over the state. She raised some concerns about the duty in the bill for prosecutors to present exculpatory evidence to the grand jury. And those points are well taken, and I was on the work group with Mr. Knott, with Brenda, with Ms. Meyer, with others. It was a very good, robust work group, and we had a lot of very good and frank discussions. The concerns that Ms. Olson raises, I think, are valid and should be addressed. One small change that I think is absolutely necessary is on page 5, line 18, where it says that the prosecutor shall present evidence reasonably tending to negate the guilt. I would urge that, at a minimum, the language known to the prosecutor be added. This is not a discovery statute. This is not a Brady statute. This is commenting on the duty of the prosecutor to present all evidence to the grand jury. But, of course, that can only be done if the prosecutor knows of that evidence. So that is another change that I am suggesting. I'm in support of this bill. My office is in support of this bill, and the Oregon District Attorney's Association is in support of this bill because, as Mr. Knott said so eloquently, it helps to seek justice for the victims of these violent crimes. I also am available to answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Who would like to go next? Danielle, would you?
Thank you, Chair Prozanski and Vice Chair and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Tudor, and I am here today to testify on behalf of this bill. It doesn't seem like it's possible, but it's only been 250 days since we were last here talking about the statute of limitations on rape. And at that time, I shared my testimony with this committee, and I will attempt to do that again today. In 1979, as a senior in high school, and a year that should have been the highlight of all my school years up to that point, a stranger broke into my childhood home and basically hunted me down in my own home in the dark and attacked me and raped me. You know, rape, I think, is always every woman's worst fear. And when it happens to you, there's no way to know really how you're going to react, because it's very much a deer in the headlights situation that you don't know what to do. I did end up calling law enforcement that evening. I had a rape kit done, and I was also able to provide law enforcement with a very key piece of evidence that actually ended up solving the case 7 years later, and that was a composite sketch of my attacker. I turned out to be the only victim out of numerous victims of Richard Gilmore, the jogger rapist, that ever got a very clear look at his face before he attacked me. You know, getting a call 7 years down the road that, you know, we have some pictures that we want you to come and look at and see if you can identify who your rapist was, and you look at those pictures and you actually see that he is there, and you can't believe it, because at this point you're thinking the case is never going to be solved. Well, what I ended up learning after that was that there were 8 victims in my neighborhood that we knew of. I was victim number 3, and that composite sketch had led law enforcement to who Richard Gilmore was and his identity. The other thing that solved our case was a fingerprint, which it can go either way, I think, on fingerprints, whether they can get DNA or not. So the two key pieces ended up being 2 victims that would never receive justice. The statute of limitations at that time was only 3 years. So there were 8 of us that had to go through the whole court system, going through trial, being cross-examined by a defense attorney, just being torn apart. And this was an individual, a rapist, that had actually admitted to all of our rapes as well. So it was a very traumatizing experience to go through the criminal justice system. Coming back and changing the statute of limitations on rape I think is the right thing to do. You know, as we've talked about, there are many reasons why a victim doesn't report right away. In my case, we did. We did report right away, and we still didn't get justice. And I think this statute, I think, takes into consideration many different situations that can happen as to why a rapist isn't brought to justice right away. And obviously, I think we know that this change is needed if, statistically, we're only sending 2% of rapists to prison in this country. And yet, every 2 minutes, someone over the age of 12 is sexually assaulted. So we're going to epidemic proportions, but yet on the other end, we need to shore up to make sure that when victims and survivors do come forward, that justice is available to them. And so I'm very glad that I can be here today to testify on behalf of this bill. And I thank this committee and Chair Prozanski for having the work group and coming out of the work group with something that you had said you would do. And I will be eternally grateful that you convened the work group and came out with something that was fair. And thank you for doing that.
Thank you. Brenda?
Yeah. Hello, Chair Prozanski and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy. I think everyone did a really great job of summing this up, so I'm just going to kind of add my own story to this. I support 1553 and the amendments. I was part of the work group. This bill this year is really special to me, actually. Last year was a win. We went from 6 years to 12, but this year is much more important to me because this bill, the way it is now, would have helped me in my own personal case. My experience with the statute of limitations in Oregon has not been good. The first time I heard of the statute of limitations was when I was 12. I was 9 when I was raped by my babysitter's boyfriend. Because he lived next door to us, or a couple houses down, I was too scared to say anything. It was not until I was 12 and we had moved out of the neighborhood that I made a report to the police, in which I was told that the statute of limitations was 3 years. It had just expired and nothing would be done. And last session I had submitted the police report actually that said the suspect would not be contacted because the statute of limitations had expired. In 1998, I was drugged and I was gang raped by 4 football players. 2 of them went to Oregon State University. I wanted justice for myself at that time, and remembering from when I was younger that making a timely report would be important, I remembered that. I made a timely report, I got a rape kit done, and I expected the wheels of justice to start turning. However, that was not the case. I was lied to by the DA. I was pressured to drop the case, which I did. 16 years later, when I came forward with my story to talk about it, an investigation was done. And at that time, I found out that I was lied to by the DA, that there were actually confessions from all 4 of my rapists. There was plenty of evidence. There was DNA in my rape kit, but it wasn't tested. It was destroyed before the statute of limitations was up, which was 6 years. So at that time last year, I was told for the second time that nothing would be done because of the statute of limitations. And I'm sorry, I'm so emotional. I told myself I wouldn't cry today because I spent all last session crying in front of you guys. But it's deeply painful and hurtful that the law does not protect people like me and people like Danielle and so many other survivors that I have talked to when we have done absolutely nothing wrong. We are victims of a crime, and then we are victims of a law that has failed us. And a lot of people make the comment to me that it wasn't the statute of limitations that failed me regarding my gang rape in 1998, and that's true. It was the system that failed me. But 16 years later, when we found out that the system failed, it was the statute of limitations that failed me. Because I did have witnesses, and I did have other people that would be able to testify for me. Things that are in this bill now could have helped me, and maybe I could pursue justice today against my rapists. So I would just ask that, number one, you pass this through because it's important, but also because it's fair. We worked in this work group really hard to make sure that this was fair, and I'm someone that believes in justice no matter what that means, whether that's victims' rights or defendants' rights. And I feel like this bill is a fair balance for both. It doesn't allow for a true he said, she said case to be brought up 20 years later. There are boundaries and parameters that we must follow. And so I feel it's very fair and I feel it's just. And I wholeheartedly support it. And I hope that you will also. And I appreciate you allowing me to speak my heart to you today. Thank you.
Thanks to both of you coming forward again and telling your stories. I know it's hard, difficult every time. But it also shares a moment for us as we have a kind of our reality as to what is best and how we can move forward. Senator Thatcher, you had a question?
Yes, thank you. I think it, well, whoever wants to answer it, but I think it'll be more directed to Aaron and Jeff. But there will be testimony likely after you that will talk about it being potentially setting up a he said, she said situation where over time evidence that might exonerate an individual might be destroyed, and that Oregon has the ability to convict somebody with a non-unanimous jury, and we don't record juries. So there are those concerns from the other side. What do you say to that?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, thank you very much for that question. I'll try to take it in the order that you asked it. There's always the possibility, because there is a law and a jury instruction that says that the testimony of one witness whom you believe is sufficient to prove a fact at issue. We have that now. It's been the law for a long time, and that does not change by this bill. But it's, you know, the key words there, and that's a jury instruction that I quoted, is whom you believe, the testimony of a witness whom you believe. We have in place a system that is designed to test the veracity of any witness through direct examination, through cross-examination, through the ability to confront and cross-examine one's accuser, and by a jury being able to see and observe how a witness testifies, their demeanor, their vocal inflections, everything else that goes into a layperson's analysis of a person's credibility. With this new statute, with this bill, what has been put in place is some very limited safeguards that would not allow a case to go forward more than 12 years old unless certain conditions precedent exist, such as statements made by the victim to another person, or written down, or logbooks, or some other corroborating evidence that would support that statement. And like Mr. Knott said, and I think it's a point that's very well taken, even then, that only gets the case to the threshold of the courtroom. There will still be, I would imagine, on a case like this, a very rigorous trial, at which time all of the evidence will be laid out in front of the decision maker, and that decision maker will have to decide whether or not the case has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's not a low standard, that's a very high standard. With regard to a couple of the other things, the non-unanimous jury, you know, that's true. In felony cases, a verdict of 10 to 2 is sufficient. But that's really a red herring in this setting. This is not about non-unanimous jury verdicts. That question has been taken up to the highest court, and that issue has been resolved by the Oregon Supreme Court, which said that non-unanimous jury verdicts are constitutional in the state of Oregon. I understand that it will it has some emotional appeal, especially in a situation like this, but it's simply a red herring as with regard to this issue. What was your other part of the question, Senator Thatcher, if I may?
The fact that we don't have recorded grand juries.
Well, that's a issue for another hearing, I would imagine. And I know that there already has been some. Let me just say this, that every prosecutor that I know takes their duty extremely seriously. If this body grants prosecutors the ability to bring forward a case based upon what a victim has said and other corroborating evidence, I don't know of any prosecutor that wouldn't take that as seriously as any homicide or any other case. What we're talking about in this situation is bringing a case into grand jury and ultimately possibly to trial where an allegation is 12, 15, 18 years old. No one that I know takes that lightly, and if granted that authority, it would be treated with the utmost respect and the utmost care. I think what Mr. Knott said is very, very true. There will be very few cases that fall under this statute. If they do come under this statute, they will be scrutinized to a degree that is seldom seen. And if they're brought to grand jury, it's because there is corroborating evidence. If there is exculpatory evidence, that is going to be considered. I mean, exculpatory evidence, evidence that tends to negate the guilt on a case this old, I would imagine that if such evidence exists, that case is not going any further. And if the case is indicted, then all of the protections that are currently in place with regard to a defendant would still be in place. Now, this doesn't do anything to negate the due process rights that a defendant has now and that a defendant will have going forward. And a motion to dismiss based upon lack of speedy trial for pre-indictment delay is a tool in a defense attorney's toolbox that they use all day, every day. If there is a due process violation because a case should have been brought but wasn't brought, then a criminal defense attorney will bring that to the court's attention. There is case law in Oregon, and there is U.S. Supreme Court case law that will counsel the court on how to decide whether or not, even though a case is would now be within the statute of limitations, it still would be violative of a defendant's due process rights for that case to go forward. I've lost cases under that case law, and I've prevailed under that case law. So it's an analysis that courts are quite able to do. They will do in these types of cases also.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'm just going to make a closing statement for this panel and for those who are following. I do want to thank the work group, including Senator Thatcher, that was part of it, and putting together this bill. I do believe that it is one that has balance and will allow for justice in the future. So thank you all very much. What we're going to do is we're going to do a little modification because of our timing. We have another bill that we have people that have come in from out of state. I am going to go ahead and take a second panel on the 1553. Then we're going to split and take testimony on the second or the third bill, and then we'll come back and pick up more, and we may have to do some of that additional testimony tomorrow. So if y'all would step back, our next panel is going to include Rod Underhill, Kenji Chigurai, and Julia Corkett, I guess it is.
Do you need the chair, Mr. Chair? Do you need the chair?
Do we need the, we do not.
Okay.
Thank you. That's going to make the tape. And as you can tell in my voice, we're a little rushed on time, so if you can keep your statements succinct, that would be appreciated.
Certainly.
Go ahead, Ms. Corkett.
Thank you very much. Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Julia Corkett. I'm a resident of Multnomah County, and I'm here today to support Senate Bill 1553. Myslan Alistair Corkett has been the victim of two very bad car accidents. They were investigated, and neither of them was his fault. No doubt all of you have heard of his accident on Mother's Day when he lost his leg. 4 years ago, he was also the victim, and I really do not like to use that word, but a car turned into him. He had 100 stitches in his mouth, and his teeth are all capped. He has a beard because he has facial scars. The person who hit him went to court and had a traffic ticket. She paid a fine of around $100 and showed proof of insurance. Luckily, we had very good medical insurance and we had very good dental insurance, but we still paid thousands and thousands of dollars to have his teeth capped. This last time, Alistair lost his leg and he's still struggling to get his prosthetic in place. And again, that was not his fault. Luckily, once again, Alistair had insurance, and because of his last accident, he happened to buy Affleck. And he's also a member of the strong Oregon biking community, so he had lots and lots of support. But there are so many people who do not have that support. And I believe this bill is not only for people like Alistair, it's for the people who can't pay to have their teeth capped, who do not have the insurance. And I want to say that I think this bill is good.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll go ahead and take the other two panelists and see if there's any questions after that.
Sounds good.
Kenji?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Kenji Sugihara. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Bicycle Racing Association. I also sit on the Oregon Tourism Commission. I am a member of the Oregon Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee to the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I am also a Scenic Bikeways Committee member. So I do lots of random things. Our organization, the Oregon Bicycle Racing Association, has around 4,300 to 4,600 members yearly. We have 44 teams, 80 promoters, and they race around 50,000 times a year. We not only race, but we also train on the road. So this sort of issue is very important to us. Also, in terms of economic impact, the tourism side, bicycle tourism has around $400 million of economic impact. And these sort of incidents that happen where people are not charged with a crime really impacts our reputation across the nation. And people are less likely to come to our state to enjoy our natural resources. And this not only impacts Portland area, but also places where we have many of our events. For example, we have events in rural Oregon, such as areas such as Jacksonville, Sandy, Prineville, and Echo, which is definitely a rural place. Almost yearly, or actually quite often, we hear of stories of people getting hit either as a pedestrian or as a cyclist. In many instances, these individuals get off with the traffic ticket. This new section gives district attorneys a new tool to pursue these individuals, especially when there's criminal negligence. Criminal negligence in itself, of course, is a fairly high standard. So listening to some of the district attorneys, the number of cases that will be impacted if this is limited to vulnerable road users would probably be around 5. So there would be no additional economic or revenue impact or impact on the general fund. So in terms of the support, my organization is definitely in support of this bill. So if there are any questions after the district attorney speaks, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Rod?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Rod Underhill. I'm the district attorney for Multnomah County. First, Senator Przanski, I want to thank you for allowing my office to bring this concept forward. I am a member of the Oregon Bicycle Racing Association as well. I've raced Kenji Sugihara several times, no doubt following his wheel is what he would tell you. I didn't have the pleasure of racing against Julia's son. He's in a different age category than myself. But I have met with her and talked with her about the tragic events that came to her son as a result of a motor vehicle impacting her son as he was traveling down a road with a friend on a training ride on one of our busy streets through, as she said, no fault of his own. His leg has been severed and his life permanently altered. I've spent nearly 28 years in a prosecutor's office. Several of them were as a supervisor directly of the vehicular crimes unit, where I've seen over the years several tragedies as they impact vulnerable road users, to include cyclists and pedestrians, all at the hands of motor vehicles oftentimes that weigh several thousand pounds. When Glenn Banfield, who I think you'll hear from later today, reviewed this case, he's one of the senior deputies who currently has that obligation of reviewing cases of this nature in my office. When he challenged himself to analyze the case and determine whether there was any criminal activity for which our office could proceed upon, he and I became increasingly frustrated. We are aware that in Oregon law, had the conduct that occurred as it related to Mr. Corquette resulted in Mr. Corquette's death, and thankfully it did not, but had it, then my office would have had a tool and we would have been able to proceed with a criminal negligence theory resulting in such a homicide. However, we were left experiencing a significant gap and our hands tied and an inability to proceed with any form of criminal prosecution in that instance and several others. And what we're describing, or what I'm describing, is where criminal negligence results in serious physical injury, not death, but serious physical injury, a debilitating lifelong injury in most instances. And as a result of that, we were unable to proceed. The case was rejected and is no complainant. The level of frustration by myself and other members of the office was palpable. It was essentially the last straw. I've seen a number of these cases, not a tremendous number, not a significant number, but I've seen a number of these cases over the years where that frustration has mounted, if you will. And this was the last straw in my from my standpoint. We spent some time putting together a piece of legislation that we thought was going to fill that gap, and we believe this does just that. We recognize that Article 1, Section 42 of the Oregon Constitution recognizes that a crime victim has a right to prompt restitution, but that only gets activated if we have a criminal prosecution that can occur in situations like you've just heard summarized by Julia relative to her son would be one of them. We've been very careful to be sensitive to the Department of Corrections resources. We have asked that this bill be treated as a crime category 4, and consequently, it is not a crime category that would allow for a prison referral under the case. It would alternatively allow for probation. It would allow for a probation officer to monitor the individual because there may be a myriad of other concerns that brought that person here, but almost equally, if not more importantly, would allow that probation officer to assist with payment schedules and restitution obligations and making right and making accountable what that person had done in our community. This bill does not address traffic accidents because what I mean by that is, because I am a pretty avid cyclist, I too have been hit by a motor vehicle. I was significantly injured, not seriously injured. Fractured ribs, bumps and bruises, those kinds of things, significant injury, would not have qualified for this bill. I went onto the hood of the car, head into the windshield, onto the ground, and many other bumps and bruises and various things. That driver engaged in simple negligence. I did not call the police, even though I was in charge of the vehicular crimes unit in Multnomah County at that time. Why? Because it was not criminal. That man engaged in an accident. He injured me very significantly, but it was not serious physical injury. This bill is a perfect blend of filling a gap where, with serious physical injury, such as has impacted the family of the Corquettes, where criminal negligence occurs by a motor vehicle to a vulnerable road user. And Oregon District Attorney's Office Agency supports this, as do I, of course. In just a moment, I support also Mr. House's comments relative to our statute of limitations, and thank you, Senator Prozanski, for the work group and the work that's been done in that area.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. excuse me. I understand the motivation to want to, you know, nail a person to the wall, but I also have concerns the other way, because it feels like maybe just because of my phobia driving and Portland sometimes, you know, there just seem like there's bicyclists coming out of nowhere all the time. But having said that, you mentioned an accident that you yourself experienced.
Yes.
That was deemed to be simple negligence. And maybe you can clarify for me, if you had been seriously injured, and you know, the same action, would, you know, the driver did the same thing, but you got hurt very badly, significantly. Yeah. Is that the line difference between criminal and simple?
No. To use my example as the foundation for trying to draw the distinction, my example, and I'll expand on it in a moment, would not have met this gap filler on two areas. One, I did not suffer serious physical injury as defined by law, despite having fractured ribs, despite losing consciousness briefly, despite later going to the hospital emergency room and series of bumps and bruises. That did not qualify as serious physical injury. And I recognize that, and I don't quarrel with it. That driver did not engage in a gross deviation from the standard of care, which is the criminal negligence standard, as opposed to the simple negligence standard that's found in civil law. Here was essentially the difference. My instance, while I was riding to work that morning in the northeast industrial area of Portland, and there was very light traffic. In fact, he and I essentially, as I recall, were the only two moving things in the area. It was dark, it was rainy, and while I did have reflective devices on my body, in retrospect, I should have had more maybe. It would have maybe changed things. The driver made a turn and then a quick turn directly in front of me. And essentially, he didn't see me under the circumstances. He did not see me, and I believe that. And the combination of light, rain, and maybe a shortcoming in my reflective devices, while I had some responsibility relative to that. I contrast that with Mr. Corquette's matter. Broad daylight, near bike boxes. He was traveling with another friend who was in front of him, who had crossed through traffic in advance of him, at the very least alerting a broad daylight scenario where a driver of a 4,000-pound motor vehicle in a heavily trafficked area with green bike boxes, who had another person, his partner, ride through the intersection in front of him, at the very least should have him on high alert. Despite that, he chose to turn right in front of Mr. Corquette, right in front of him. Mr. Corquette had a green light, was traveling through the intersection, and essentially was defenseless and impacted the motor vehicle. His leg was severed.
I guess I want to clarify. So the person who was tragically hit, the driver, actually focused on the driver. The driver purposely turned in front of him?
Yes.
Didn't even claim that he couldn't see him?
Oh, he claimed he didn't see him.
And I also wonder if many people outside of the Portland area or even Eugene or wherever they have green bike boxes are familiar with what that means.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that a lot of people do.
Well, I don't know. I do know this. This instance, for example, our review would have taken this case, Mr. Corquette's, to the grand jury. The grand jury would have either indicted or not indicted. If indicted, it would have proceeded, and you heard testimony relative to those next steps of counsel-appointed obligations of litigation, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and all the other protections. Simply having what I believe is filling the gap in a very finite number of cases, ways, but very significant impact to a family and an individual and a community is certainly worth it.
All right. If that's good for now, I'm going to go ahead and ask y'all to step back. Thank you very much. We are going to recess at this point Senate Bill 1553, and the purpose for that is open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1576 to take in some testimony of people who traveled over 100 miles.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1576 comes to you from Senator Monroe. It prohibits a manufacturer or distributor of prescription contact lenses from preventing a retailer from selling or advertising those contact lenses at a price set below that by the manufacturer or distributor. You had a similar bill in 2015, and this committee decided to wait and see what happened with some federal cases. Utah went ahead and adopted the statute, and it is now in litigation in the 10th Circuit.
All right, thank you. Sean, why don't you come forward? And as he's coming up, I'm going to ask, we have three individuals, Nicole Rush, Carol Alexander, and it looks like Tico. If you will please come forward, I'm not going to butcher your last name. I apologize.
Thank you.
And so we'll need a fourth chair. Sean, I'm going to go ahead and let you go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, today representing 1-800-CONTACTS. I do appreciate you indulging us with having a hearing again on this bill that you all did here in 2015. I wanted to bring you up to speed a little bit, and I know that Senator Rosenbaum wasn't on the committee at that point in time as well, so I'll try and be brief and cover a little of the background. As you all know, the contact lens market is controlled primarily by four major manufacturers that control almost 100% of the market. And since we brought this bill in 2015, as Chana stated, it did go, a similar bill went into effect in Utah. The bill is actually in effect while it's pending an appeal. The major manufacturers sued for injunctive relief, and that's what's under appeal at this point in time, but that was not granted by the federal district court. And a lot of what I'll quote from today is sort of the findings of the district court as they looked at the bill itself. They found that the lens industry has two key features that make it particularly susceptible to anti-competitive conduct. Contact lens may be sold only pursuant to a valid prescription from an eye care professional. Each prescription is brand and model specific, and unlike doctors who are prohibited from selling drugs, they prescribe, eye care professionals sell the very contacts that they prescribe to individuals. What this bill is not about, Mr. Chair, it's not about that relationship between the eye care professional and their consumer. In no way does 1-800-CONTACTS want to impact that particular relationship. What this bill is about is manufacturers and whether or not they can arbitrarily establish a price for what retailers must sell the contacts for. That is the simple purpose of this bill. I know it's longer. The only reason the bill is longer is it's in the UTPA, and every time you amend the UTPA, you have to include the entire UTPA in there. It really is just a simple paragraph saying, for retailers, the manufacturers can sell for whatever price they want to the retailer, but on the back end, they can't tell them exactly how much they have to sell it for. Since unilateral pricing policy has gone into effect in the last 2 years in the contact lens market, there have been over 40 class action lawsuits filed on behalf of consumers claiming damage for the increase in prices that they've had to endure. And there has been state-specific legislation similar to this in 9 other states. This has also been a subject in Congress, as we informed you all of last time, where Congress enacted the Fairness to Contact Lens Consumers Act. And the purpose of that basically was to enhance competition in the marketplace, to make it more realistic for consumers to go outside of their eye care professional when they were looking for contact lenses. They still have to have a valid prescription. Every retailer has to ensure that they have a valid prescription. But once that prescription is given, they can then go outside of that. I'll close with this, Mr. Chair, because I know that you're very late, but the Utah District Court, when analyzing originally, and they haven't ruled on it officially yet because of the injunction and that being appealed, but they said their finding was the statute merely requires that manufacturers refrain from mandating price fixing within the state and from discriminating against retailers for reasons related to price fixing. That's what they found in the district court. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions about the details of the bill, and thank you again for hearing it today.
All right, thank you. Sean, I'm going to hold off on questions for you. I had three people I called up. I'd like for those three to please come forward. Again, Nicole, Carol, and Takeo. I'm probably not doing that correct. Sorry.
Trevor?
No, I don't have Trevor. Trevor's a different person. Sean, why don't you go ahead and pull, why don't we go ahead and take all four of you? I'm leaving Aaron Ott out because he can come back if we are going forward on this. Though I apologize for the lateness of our time, if you can give us your name and your testimony, and if you can try not to repeat each other, that would be great. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Trevor Cleveland, an optometrist in private practice in Springfield. I serve as the immediate past president for the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. Thank you very much for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing and to speak with you about the care that I and my fellow optometrists provide for our patients, particularly those who wear contact lenses. Speaking for the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, we are strongly opposed to Senate Bill 1576 that would seek to eliminate unilateral pricing policies on contact lenses in Oregon, as we are certain there will be long-term negative implications for our patients should this legislation become law. The Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, with nearly 800 members, is the leading voice for the optometric profession in Oregon, and we have clinics in almost every county in the state. As you're aware, optometrists provide full-range primary eye care that includes diagnosis and treatment of many eye diseases, in addition to fitting and prescribing of contact lenses. Contact lenses are regulated medical devices that cannot be purchased without a prescription. Doctors of optometry, unlike contact lens retailers, have a code of ethics and professional oversight by state licensing boards. The requirement for the prescription is not itself an indication of any type of anti-competitive, anti-consumer action, as the requirement of the prescription is based on ensuring patient safety. Optometrists take pride in what they do, and they value the trusted relationships formed with their patients and patients' families in your communities. With contact lens wearers, particularly new contact lens wearers, there is careful follow-up to evaluate the lens performance and interaction with the eye tissue, in addition to how the patient is experiencing the ongoing comfort, vision, specific care regimen for the lens. This affords the opportunity and the time to be assured as practitioners that the patient is understanding the care and hygiene of contacts while checking for questions or concerns before they become complications. Once a contact lens fitting or prescribing process is complete, the doctor has now assumed responsibility for the release of this prescription to the patient, and the contact lenses can be purchased. My colleague, Dr. Rush, can explain some of the safety aspects in detail.
Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Cruz and members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak to you on behalf of our patient safety today. My name is Nicole Rush, and I'm an optometric physician on the southern coast of Oregon, and I live in a very rural area. My patient's eye health takes precedent both day and night, as we don't have any access to urgent care facilities or any specialists where I live. I see patients at all hours of the week as well as weekends, and a substantial amount of these eye health issues are contact lens related. It's a real problem. Contact lenses are a federally regulated medical device. A doctor's supervision for their proper fit and use is required. A contact lens prescription written by an eye doctor includes numerous measurements to fit each and every patient's individually shaped eye, along with a wearing schedule and a replacement schedule. Every one, single one of the parameters can adversely affect the patient's vision and ocular health if not chosen properly. I don't know how an online retailer can know this information. Not all contact lenses are created equal. 1-800-CONTACTS website requires a patient to choose their curvature from a list of options. And how is a patient to know the fit without seeing an optometrist? Not only is the initial fit important, but continued analysis is critical too. You that wear glasses or contact lenses on the committee understand that your vision's constantly changing. Otherwise, you would just purchase one pair of eyeglasses for your entire life. So not only is your vision correction changing, but also is the overall shape of your eye, your tear film chemistry, your corneal oxygen requirements. These things can happen for many reasons, such as aging, systemic health conditions, or medications. There are many things about eyes that need to be reviewed yearly to assure our patients' best vision and eye health. In my 15 years of practice, I have seen such misuse of contact lenses that even some patients have caused permanent scarring of their corneas, leaving them with lifelong vision loss and the inability to ever wear contact lenses again. And what is most appalling is that in almost every case, it could have been avoided with proper care by the lens, by the patients of their lenses and their appropriate follow-up care with their eye doctor. I had a patient in my office just last week who had been to the ER the night before. Her eye hurt so much she couldn't even open it, and now she was on day 3 of missing work. Prior to seeing me, she hadn't made any connection to her contact lenses. She said she had been wearing some contact lenses she purchased online about 6 months ago. She had no idea they were actually supposed to be replaced between 2 and 4 weeks. The lens was completely molded onto her eye when I saw her. She not only had an infection of her cornea, but also a bunch of new blood vessels growing onto her cornea, which is supposed to be clear. We have discontinued her contact lenses and started treatment, but still undetermined if she'll be able to ever wear contact lenses again in the future. This woman is lucky. She didn't go blind, but not every case like this has a happy ending. So in closing, my colleagues and I do insist on the best contact lens products to meet each and every patient's needs. Each is unique. We want to protect them from any harm they may experience from misusing contact lenses. Our patients trust us with one of their most valued possessions, their eyesight. And we're hopeful that you will join with the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association in putting Oregon residents' healthcare ahead of corporate profits. Please oppose Senate Bill 1576.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Me. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Carol Alexander. I am an optometrist, and I've practiced optometry for 20 years before joining Johnson & Johnson. I'm here today representing Johnson & Johnson Vision Care and would urge your opposition to Senate Bill 1576. My testimony is about a Johnson & Johnson medical device, our line of contact lenses, perhaps best known to you by the name AccuView. As a business in a very competitive industry, we are constantly looking for ways to succeed and grow by supporting healthy vision practices and providing the best lenses at affordable prices to both doctors and patients. To help accomplish that goal, we introduced a new pricing policy in 2014, a unilateral pricing policy, or UPP. Let me highlight the intent and outcome of that unilateral pricing policy. First, you have to know that it was accompanied by a drop in wholesale prices on our AccuView brand products to all resellers. Most resellers have passed along those savings to their customers by lowering prices on AccuView brand contact lenses. Second, it allows doctor and patient conversations to focus on eye care needs, not special offers. Before unilateral pricing policies, doctors and patients often spent valuable time in discussing what were the many pricing deals and rebates on various types of lenses. Third, it simplifies our pricing on products so that consumers can easily shop and quickly see bottom line prices are not tied to any kind of a rebate or a marketing gimmick. And finally, it maintains consumer choice in the decision of where they buy their lenses. So with the Federal Contact Lens Consumer Act that releases the prescription to the patient, whether they want to buy online, in a store, in a doctor's office, the choice continues to be the choice of the patient. Over the last year and a half, unilateral pricing policy has worked. It has not only brought price transparency to our products, but it has lowered prices for AccuView brand contacts for the majority of consumers. Senate Bill 1576 seeks to make unilateral pricing policies only on contact lenses illegal, but it's not the answer. This legislation would interfere with our right as a manufacturer to compete in the marketplace using existing legal pricing practices. To date, 12 states have considered legislation similar to Senate Bill 1576, and only one state, Utah, passed such legislation. The Utah legislation has been tied up in litigation since the time it was signed into law and is now under review, as you heard, by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. As we await guidance from the courts, we welcome discussion on how to continue to improve the marketplace and ensure constituents have access to our medical devices at affordable prices, but Senate Bill 1576 is not the answer. Unfortunately, the reality is, despite receiving a lower wholesale cost, 1-800-CONTACT still has not lowered their retail prices on all of our products. And worse, they've mischaracterized our policy. That brings us to what this bill is really about. One company seeking to increase market share at the expense of contact lens wearers. Rather than compete in the marketplace, 1-800-CONTACT wants you to legislate an advantage for them. Thank you, and I encourage your opposition to Senate Bill 1576. My colleague, Mr. Murrah from J&J, doesn't have formal testimony, but he is our director of pricing and available if you had questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate the clarification. Let me ask, are there any questions for the panel? Senator Thatcher.
I think I just had a short clarification, Carol. with all the different pricing schemes that could have happened before the UPP, are you saying that another lens might have been prescribed that might not have been for the best only because of price?
No, I think pricing conversations are always interesting for doctors and patients because patients care how much a lens costs, and so do the providers. So you're always looking at, you know, what will be in the best interest of the patient. And most doctors, I would say close to all, are always going to recommend the what they think is best, obviously, first. And price does come into the conversation. And so what is troubling about the pricing conversation is that it's not simplistic. It's not, here's what this lens is and here's how much it costs. If you are a consumer of that product, well, doc, what's it cost in your office? Well, it costs this, and then there's this rebate if you do that. And then if you go online, you might see other, you know, as low as price, but then you have to read the small print. And the as low as price is you have to buy an entire year's supply at one time, and you have to apply for the rebate. You have to send the rebate in to get it. So it's just the complexity of the pricing conversation that we think has been simplified by a unilateral price policy.
Thank you all very much. I'm going to go ahead and let you all step back. Was there any questions for Mr. Jillians? All right. Thank you all very much. So at this point, I have one other person to testify on this bill, but what we're going to do, that's Aaron Knott. I'm going to hold off since you're in the neutral position. And what we're going to do is going to, let's see if we can pick anyone else up. I think we need to go back to 1553, but before we do that, colleagues, I know we're now after the hour. I'm assuming you all probably need to leave, or do you have time to do a work session?
Mr. Chair, we need to do the work session.
All right, we're going to open up a work session on.
Close the public hearing.
Well, I thought I just thought I closed it. Close it, and then we're opening up the work session on Senate Bill 1552, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill. I see we
to adopt the Dash One Amendment.
Dash one.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash One Amendment to Senate Bill 1552.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the Dash One Amendment into Senate Bill 1552. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1552 as amended by the Dash One Amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1552 as amended by the Dash Ones to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Thatcher first.
Just very quickly, I have some concerns about the rules just going into action without legislative approval.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, I can understand those concerns, but there will be legislative oversight and legislative review. We know that, and we will make sure that's on the record, and so it is part of the record, and it will happen.
All right. Thank you. Senator Gelser.
Thank you. And I just wanted to – I communicated with Chana. There may be some further changes on the House side, I understand. Those amendments are in, Senator Gelser. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll see this product again before it actually comes across. And as Senator Cruz said, there's going to be a check and balance based on the timing of everything for the 17 session. I have another opportunity to review it as we go through this process. I will state that the we're sending this to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The President's office may look at it and decide to send it to Ways and Means because it does have anticipated fiscal that could be right on the edge of whether they think it needs to go down or not. So
Mr. Chair, in response to that, and also a message to the President's office, is this is marginal. That fiscal could be within a standard book of business of the agencies, but I would also suggest that it would be better if this bill went to the House for further clarification then came back to us rather than going to Ways and Means. Just on the record.
Our thoughts.
Okay. Our thoughts.
Committee thoughts. We send with love, right?
Absolutely.
All righty. With that, is there any objection to the motion to adopt, to send to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, Senate Bill 1552 as amended by the Dash Ones?
Yes.
Senator Thatcher is a no. Anyone else? So ordered, and it's on its way to wherever it's going, hopefully to the floor. And Senator Cruz will be our carrier on 1552. With that, then, let me go ahead and go through what we have here. On 1553, we have 1, 2, 3, 4. I have 5 individuals who have signed up to testify. And of those 5, Jeff, I know you can be back. Mr. Banfield, why don't you come forward, because you're probably here on today only. So, Mr. Banfield, why don't we get your testimony? And colleagues, if you need to leave, feel free to do so. The record's going to stay open. But, Mr. Banfield, I wanted to get your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz. My name is Glenn Banfield, and I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1553. Just briefly, my job, I supervise about 9 attorneys in a major felony unit, which includes prosecuting cases of vehicular assaults and homicides and serious physical injury cases. I work very closely with all of those attorneys that prosecute those cases from the beginning of the case through the negotiation process, charging decision, as well as preparation for trial if necessary. Also, in my role as a supervisor of that unit, work very closely with law enforcement agencies in the investigation of these types of cases, oftentimes responding to the scene, working with them on preservation and collection of evidence, and working with writing warrants and obtaining warrants as well. A big part of the job that we do, specifically dealing with these serious physical injury and vehicular homicide cases, is assisting victims that come to our office, help them navigate through the criminal justice system. As you can imagine, when you're a victim of these types of crime, it could be an extremely traumatic and painful experience. And the criminal justice system can be a bit daunting at times. So I see a large part of our role is advising and helping them navigate through the criminal justice decision system. I won't talk too much about what the bill does. Mr. Underhill spoke exactly about what the bill does. But in essence, the bill amends ORS 163.165. And what it does is it adds to assault in the third degree, and it says that when assault in the third degree is committed when, with criminal negligence, a person causes another person serious physical injury by the use of a motor vehicle. And it's important to note, as Mr. Underhill noted, that we're talking about serious physical injury here. We're not talking about bumps and bruises from a fender bender. We're talking about injury that could potentially cause the loss of life, or that causes permanent or protracted disfigurement, or the use of a bodily organ, as in Mr. Alistair Corquette's case, a severing of a limb, debilitating, life-threatening injuries, and that's what we're trying to focus with this bill, and also we're trying to help protect vulnerable victims within our community, pedestrians and cyclists, and not necessarily other motorists. So we're looking at the most vulnerable of road users, and we're looking at the most serious of injuries that these road users incur as a result of criminal negligent behavior from other road users, particularly motor vehicles. This bill, I think, would help us in having another tool in the charging decision. You know, when we get these cases from the beginning, as I said, we respond to the scene and we're working very closely with gathering evidence and investigating the case. And what we're looking at is whether or not we are able to, I guess, fit the fact pattern into a set of circumstances that allows us to determine whether intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly this person has caused physical injury or serious physical injury to another person. And sometimes, I mean, that's where our analysis would end unless we can fit it into an area of criminal negligence. And in this case, particularly the Alistair Corquette case, there's no doubt in my mind that we would have taken this case to grand jury because of criminal negligence. What Mr. Allen did in that case is he clearly violated the rules of the road. Mr. Corquette clearly had the right of way. He was visible. It was broad daylight. He was riding on the road. And Mr. Allen needed to yield the right of way to Mr. Corquette, and he did not. And so he was in clear violation of the law. Now, the problem is, although he's in violation of the law, the traffic offense, his conduct did not necessarily raise to the level of reckless conduct. But I do believe that it did raise to the level of criminal negligence. That is,
Recklessness requires that he be aware of and consciously disregard that awareness that he potentially could cause serious physical injury. For criminal negligence, what we're asking is that should he have been aware, and his failure to be aware, was that a gross deviation? And in this particular case, he should have been aware because of the time of the day and because of the busy intersection and because he had to be aware to yield the right of way. And that did not happen. And this bill would allow us to at least take the question to a grand jury or a trier of fact, members of the community, to determine whether or not there should be some criminal culpability.
Mr. Banfield, thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Thank you very much. With that, we're going to be closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 1553. Now, at this point, I do need to go through what we're carrying over. We'll be carrying over 1553.
Public hearing and work session.
Yeah, for public hearing and work session, we're also are carrying over 1555 for possible work session, and 1576 is we're going to just put that into a possible work session mode unless Mr. Knott, Aaron, did you need to put something on the record? Do you want us to leave it open for public hearing?
On 1576?
Yeah.
I can talk you offline if that's easier.
Okay, we'll just do that. So at this point, we'll carry that over for a possible work session. That's just to get through the formalities, just to make certain we don't lose anything right this second. But with that, we're going to close for the day. I think we've covered the three bills as to what we're doing, and we've met the criteria. With that, we're adjourned. With that, we're adjourned. The criteria.